Laris, the Jihad engineer, and Vega in tow. A short, sharp laugh from Captain Cthu surprised Alistair.
You've got your hands full there, Colonel. If you'll excuse me, I must see to final preparations before launch.
Of course, Captain, said Alistair. The El-Shah made his way back into his ship, already deep in discussion with someone over his comms link. Well, this is going to be fun, intoned Tim sarcastically. Look at it this way, Tim, Alistair said with a grin. If Vega shoots Dr. Wong before we get where we are going, we can all turn around and come home. Now, why don't you show me where I can store my gear, and we can get this show on the road? With a smoothness that belied the power that was required to complete the action, the Glambring maneuvered itself clear of Prime Base. Once it had reached a safe distance, the frigate slowed, allowing the ship's two dropships to catch up.
Dropship secure, Captain.
Captain Cthu acknowledged the report absent-mindedly as he concentrated on the navigation display. In the space around Prime Base, the staggering firepower of the winged hussars was massing, readying itself for the operation to flee their comrades held captive by forces loyal to General Peepo.
Well, there's something you don't see every day, said Alistair, as his repeater display showed the enhanced view from one of the Glambring's exterior cameras.
Cthu depressed the pedal with one foot, spinning his chair to face Alistair while remaining securely strapped in.
I have not seen a mobilization like this in my lifetime, Colonel. I fear that this is only a sign of what is to come.
The El-Shah's observation wiped away any levity or wonder Alistair may have had at the sight of so many tons of warships readying for battle. In its place, he now felt a burgeoning sense of dread. Cthu's years among humans had made him adept at recognizing human facial expressions. So without another word, he spun his chair once more to face forward, returning his gaze to the navigation trivy, double-checking the course which Glambring's navigator had plotted to the Stargate, and onward to Rala Station. Alistair felt the familiar pressure of acceleration push him back into his padded seat as the Glambring came under power, like the thoroughbred racehorse that she was. Turning his head to the left, his eyes hovered over the lithe figure of Anna May Wong. Her blank expression belied the furious activity going on behind it as, through her pinplants, she constantly monitored every system aboard ship.
No doubt, thought Alistair. Her assistant Laris is doing the same thing from engineering.
Behind Anna, strapped into a makeshift jump seat, Vega sat maintaining his silent vigil. Accessing his own pinplants, Alistair checked on the status of his troopers sequestered away in Glambring's marine spaces. Each Scorpion trooper's name was tinged in the green, good-to-go color. Reassured, Alistair accessed the ship's exterior cameras again, forcing himself to relax and enjoy the view. For now, he was only a passenger. However, things would get interesting when they reached Rala. Late morning on day two of the transit to Rala, the gravity deck of the Glambring rang out in protest as the heavy metallic feet of half a dozen Caspers thumped across it. As Alistair Sinclair watched, assessing the Caspers' intricate maneuvers with a critical eye, Lieutenant Carolyn Verley tried and failed to hide her almost parental need to join the troopers of 3rd Platoon. The platoon had already lost nearly half its strength and all its senior members, who now lay prone, scattered across the deck when their Caspers had registered critical or fatal hits. Alistair smiled inwardly while on the outside maintaining his aura of neutrality.
He fully understood Verley's desire to jump in among her troopers and prevent the train wreck toward which they were inevitably barreling. However, this was not a test of her leadership skills, nor of the platoon's sergeant, Farouk Shadid, who stood quietly to one side under the watchful gaze of First Sergeant Ethan Kroll. Not that Alastair didn't trust Sergeant Shadid, but he wouldn't be the first senior NCO to attempt to influence a training exercise which his colonel had decided to drop in on. On the deck in front of them, the scenario faced by the remaining troopers of 3rd Platoon, now commanded by a junior corporal, continued to play out. And it looked bleak. From behind a simulated barricade, members of Support Platoon were laying down withering laser fire on the stalled 3rd Platoon assault, before suddenly, three members of the assaulting platoon went to one knee, shoulder to shoulder, snapping on their laser shields and deflecting the incoming fire harmlessly away. Behind them, the remaining three Casper-suited troopers activated their own laser shields, raising them over their kneeling comrades until all six shields interlocked, forming an impenetrable wall. As one, the troopers advanced on their enemy until they reached and then breached the barricade. The battle was over in moments as the Caspers closed to knife-fighting range. 4-foot-long steel blades flashed under the high-intensity gravity-deck lighting. The barricade's defenders were slaughtered.
"Okay, Lieutenant, I've seen enough," said Alastair. "Keep working on enforcing the ethic that every trooper needs to stand ready to take on the responsibility of the trooper above him in the chain of command. Combat is unpredictable, and there is no guarantee that those in positions of command will survive first contact with the enemy."
"Understood, sir," replied Verley.
"Remember, Carradine, every day is a school day. You are never finished learning in this job. That corporal's use of the testudo is exactly the kind of initiative we need to foster. I bet the Romans never thought that we would still be using the tortoise formation 2,000 years after they first used it to protect their legionnaires."
Finally, a smile cracked Verley's hard face.
"Well, sir, if it was good enough for the Romans, it's good enough for the Scorpions."
Alastair let out a short, barking laugh.
"Exactly, Karen. Exactly."
Leaving the lieutenant to debrief her troopers, Alastair headed for the exit, fully intending to enjoy an early lunch. First, Sergeant Kroll fell into lockstep beside him, something which Alastair knew did not bode well, as Kroll had 4 more combat scenarios to supervise that afternoon.
"Out with it, First Sergeant."
Kroll cleared his throat before speaking, another sign Alastair would not like what he was about to say.
"It would appear, sir, we have a somewhat delicate situation brewing in the Casper storage room."
"What kind of situation?"
demanded Alastair with a quizzically raised eyebrow, noticing that the muscles at the edge of Kroll's lips were quivering as the first sergeant suppressed the urge to smile.
"I'll not ask you again, First Sergeant," Alastair said menacingly.
By now, the smile which had threatened to appear on Kroll's face had transformed into what Alastair's father would have called a shit-eating grin.
"Captain Buchanan has confined Engineer Rallis to the brig after he found the Jihad carapace deep inside one of our Caspers, and Dr. Wong is explaining to Captain Buchanan, using a few choice words which I have never heard before, why the captain should release Laris. In return, Captain Buchanan is using a similar vocabulary to put forward his side of the argument."
Thoughts of a well-deserved breakfast were chased away as a low, rumbling anger descended on Alastair, and he spun around and stalked off in the direction of the Casper storage room. The Glambring was not the largest of ships in the Winged Hussar's fleet, by a long way. Nor did it have the largest crew, with only 26 officers and 80 enlisted. Add that to the 27 personnel of all ranks from the Scorpions, Count Dr. Wong and her assistant Laris, and the total complement of the frigate came to 135. As Alastair Sinclair turned the last bend in the corridor leading to the entrance of the Casper storage area, he was confronted by what Alastair could only assume was every single living soul aboard, squashed into the access way. The noise of raised voices, one male, one female, echoed off the walls. Each sentence was emphasized by oohs and ahs from the gathered onlookers. For the first time in his life, Alastair Sinclair was lost for words. At his shoulder, First Sergeant Kroll was not.
"Make a hole before I stick my boot where the sun most definitely does not shine," he roared.
Like the sea parting before Moses, the multiple races on the corridor attempted to force themselves into the corridor walls, allowing a now fully enraged Alastair past. Kroll glared at every face as he passed them by, his unspoken command causing the petrified crewmen and troopers to suddenly realize they had important work to do elsewhere. Alastair entered the storage room and found Tim Buchanan, all 6 feet 4 inches of him, standing toe-to-toe with a 5 feet 2 inch anime Wong. Each were bright red-faced as they screamed at each other while jabbing at the other with pointed fingers like dueling swordsmen. Arrayed around the walls of the room stood several Scorpion troopers, all grinning from ear to ear as they watched Tim and Anna spar with each other. When they realized that Colonel Sinclair and his personal attack dog, First Sergeant Kroll, were now in their midst, grins disappeared in an instant. Kroll locked his best, "consider-yourself-not-wanted-here" look on the ranking noncoms, who immediately began ushering everybody out of the room. The only trooper who remained unmoved was Corporal Vega, standing stoically to one side, right hand resting on his people stopper, while in his left, Kroll's eyes lit on the unmistakable outline of a stun baton. Kroll's gaze moved up to Vega's face, and each man assessed the other for a fraction of a second. It finally dawned on Kroll that Vega was prepared to stun Buchanan, his superior officer and de facto second in command of the Merc Company, if things got physical between Buchanan and Vega's charge, Dr. Wong. For his part, Vega held the first sergeant's gaze for a few seconds, ensuring that Kroll understood that the corporal was willing to do what was necessary to guard his protectee, before shrugging his shoulders and returning his attention to the pair, giving each other a tongue-lashing in the center of the room. Kroll's head and shoulders swiveled back to the front where Alastair was standing, feet apart, hands on hips, as if waiting for the arguing pair to notice his presence. It didn't seem like it was about to happen anytime soon, as the shouting failed to diminish in either volume or choice vocabulary.
"This would never have happened if your pet millipede had kept his claws out of my Casper," shouted Tim. "What was he doing in there anyway? A bit of industrial espionage, eh? Trying to figure out how our suits perform better than a hussar's?"
Anna's head drew back, as if she was about to headbutt Tim square on the nose. Instead, she screamed her own retort.
"You have to be joking! Your suits are pieces of junk compared to what our Marines are equipped with. He was probably trying to figure out how in entropy you keep them from falling apart."
Tim leaned in close to the elfin woman, who refused to flinch.
"Now you listen here, missy. Why don't you go back to your crib and play with your toys and leave?"
Whatever Tim was about to say next was mute, as Anna's face flushed and her open hand struck Tim across the cheek with a resounding slap. For a brief instant, the room fell silent. Anna's eyes bulged, and her mouth formed a large O as she realized what she had done. Tim's fighting instinct told him to strike back, his right fist formed into a ball, muscles in his arm quivering with pent-up energy, preparing to smash his aggressor into a bloody smear on the deck. Kroll caught a movement off to his left as Vega pushed off the wall, stun baton extended, and targeted for Tim's exposed back. Kroll began to move in what he knew would be a vain attempt to intercept Vega before he reached and stunned his target. A guttural roar like thunder filled the room.
Enough!
Every head in the room snapped in the direction of Alastair Sinclair. Face red, neck muscles and veins straining against the skin. The colonel's rage was evident, and enough to stop even Vega, who snapped to attention, stun baton still held in his hand. Kroll and Tim followed the corporal's example, moving to the position of attention so fast they felt as if their spines might break in two. Anna may not have been a mercenary. However, she had been brought up on Prime Base and lived her entire adult life surrounded by them. So she understood plainly when she was in the presence of a superior officer, and when, like now, she had overstepped the mark. Taking a deep breath, she opened her mouth to apologize, only for Alastair to shut her down.
Dr. Wong, you are to return to your quarters immediately, and remain there until such time as I deem fit, said Alastair.
If I could explain, Colonel,
Anna began.
Now, Dr. Wong, if you please,
Alastair said. His tone brokered no argument, and his eyes, hard as flint, zeroed on Tim. Anna scrubbed at her face with her hands, before releasing a heavy sigh and heading for the door, only to halt after a couple of steps and turn to face Tim.
My apologies, Captain Buchanan.
Spinning on her heel, Anna fled the room. Without waiting for permission, Vega followed, the stun baton now absent from his left hand, returned to wherever he had concealed it. That left Alastair, Tim, and First Sergeant Kroll alone in the room. Without taking his eyes from Tim, Alastair addressed Kroll over his shoulder, with a voice so cool it would have turned helium into a liquid.
Give us the room, please, First Sergeant.
Yes, sir.
Alastair waited as Kroll stepped out and slapped the door control pad as he passed it. The gentle hiss of the pneumatics as the heavy door closed was the only thing to penetrate the deathly silence which had descended on the room. The silence extended as Tim continued to stand at attention, eyes fixed on a point slightly above head height on the smooth, seamless metal wall of the storage room. Tim sensed, rather than heard, Alastair circle around him slowly. And when the colonel spoke, his voice held only one thing. Disappointment.
How long have we known each other, Tim?
For as long as I can remember, sir. My father was your father's second in command when he was colonel of the Scorpions. When our fathers were killed during the operation on Ulak IV, you inherited the company. I had just completed my vows and been accepted into the company.
An uneasy quiet, as both men remembered their lost fathers and the hole their deaths left in their lives. When Alastair spoke again, it was with a huskiness to his voice.
I was only a captain when my father was killed. Overnight I became a colonel, and the man who had seemed irreplaceable. Now,
a sanguine chuckle escaped Alastair.
Indestructible. Was gone. Within a year, my wife died, leaving me to raise three young kids. I had no idea how I was going to do that, but I did my best, Tim. Maybe not as well as I should or could have. But damn it, Tim, I tried.
Alastair completed his slow circling of Tim, and now stood directly in front of him once more. The junior man remained stock still, his eyes fixed on the wall, having not been released from the position of attention.
Now I have sent Jamie on some foolhardy mission to steal a bunch of 100-foot-tall metal monsters. Charlie, for all I know, could be dead in a ditch on Galax. And Nikki? Entropy knows where the peacemakers have her.
Alistair laid an unexpected hand on Tim's shoulder. Unexpected enough that Tim broke discipline and looked his friend and boss in the eye.
I need your head in the game, Tim. We don't have time for whatever is going on between you and Dr. Wong.
Tim failed to swallow on his first attempt, but was more successful on the second.
Sir, Alistair, every time I see that woman, my skin feels like someone has stuck needles in it. When she speaks to me, it's like she is challenging everything I say, undermining me.
Or possibly trying to get you to take notice of her? I met a woman like that once. Damned insufferable, she was. Complete pain in my ass,
Alistair said. One corner of his mouth tugged upward, hinting at a smile. Tim thought he must have misinterpreted what Alistair was saying, and he stumbled over his words to get clarity.
And, what did you do about her?
Alistair's features dissolved as he let out a long belly laugh. When he finally stopped, he was forced to wipe away a tear from one eye.
Good God, Tim, your face!
He chuckled again.
Why, I married her, of course.
Now, let's go and get poor Laris out of the brig, shall we?
Chapter 8. Why did it have to be purple? With a gentle bump, the pilot of the dropship sat down on the landing platform assigned to them by Rala Station Traffic Control. As the rear ramp cracked open, a short, sharp, high-pitched whistle filled the troop bay for a couple of seconds before tapering away as the air pressure within the dropship equalized with that of the space station. Alistair and Tim swallowed rapidly a couple of times to clear their ears, and not for the first time, Alistair found himself envious of the half-dozen El Shah, who were the humans' companions on this little furlough. The El Shah's lack of an auditory canal meant the little lizards failed to notice the discomfort afflicting their human companions. Alistair ensured the magnetic grips built into his ship boots were activated before releasing his securing straps and standing upright, towering over the tallest El Shah, who were gleefully waiting to search the markets and dealerships of Rala Station for supplies. Supplies which the Glambring had no need of whatsoever, but, as Captain Cthu had quite rightly pointed out, what better excuse for stopping over for an indefinite period than the need to conduct urgent repairs and renew dwindling foodstuffs? The sight of Tim tugging at the unfamiliar purple one-piece jumpsuit caused Alistair to let out a deep chuckle. Tim stopped his pulling and tugging to give his boss a baleful glance.
"I feel like a baby Ugar in a romper suit,"
Tim moaned. His second-in-command's discomfort only made Alistair chuckle again as he tried to picture what a baby Ugar would look like in a romper suit and failed miserably.
"The less we look like human mercs, the better." It would sort of defeat the point of Laris disguising the Glambering's encoder signature if we strolled around the station in our own uniforms, would it not? And what could be less threatening than an El Shah recovery crew taking a damaged ship back to the shipyards for repair and overhaul?
Tim gave a shrug as he finished wrestling with a jumpsuit, admitting defeat. He knew Alistair was right, but still... Purple? Really? A dark thought passed through Tim's brain. Was this that Jiha's ongoing revenge for nearly squashing him during one of the numerous Casper training exercises the Scorpions had run during the 170-hour journey through hyperspace? Or perhaps for that short spell in the brig, Tim had subjected the Jiha to after he found him tampering with Tim's suit? How was Tim to know that the engineer had noticed a slight hesitation in the Casper's servo motors and had decided to investigate? That confrontation had ended up in Tim having a blazing row with Anime Wong, in full view of the Glambring's crew and Tim's own troopers. Something that had led to Alistair having to intervene, and forcing Tim to face up to the uncomfortable truth that perhaps his feelings toward Anna were more complex than he was willing to admit. For the remainder of the journey, he had pointedly avoided any situation where he had to spend any more time than necessary in the woman's presence. Tim shook his head, dismissing the image of Anna from his brain, and concentrating on his current gripe. The color of his coveralls. He wouldn't put it past the multi-legged, multi-armed, smug little engineer whom Tim had learned after an extremely uncomfortable experience when someone, and he had his suspicions, had slipped powdered Kanara seeds into his Casper's ventilation system. Kanara seeds were normally used in tiny proportions to flavor food by chefs who wore protective gloves. Though Kanara could add a delightful tingling sensation to food, it was not the same story when more than a nominal amount contacted unprotected skin. When added to a Casper's ventilation system and blown around so that every piece of exposed skin was covered in a film of the highly irritating seed, the results were, to say the least, painful. Tim had cracked his suit and bound it out like a rat up a drainpipe. However, even the limited exposure had left him gagging for breath, while his skin had turned bright purple from contact with the Kanara. It had taken more force of will than he thought he possessed not to scratch his own skin off as the Kanara burned at his skin. A night spent in a soothing med-gel bath had cleared the last remnants of the seeds from his skin, while the medical nanites had done their efficient work. By the time he emerged from the Glambring's medbay the following morning, he looked entirely normal again, with no long-term effects. Except, of course, to his pride. The purple jumpsuits, which had been produced by the Glambring's materials synthesizer, were too close of a color match, in Tim's opinion, to his own skin color that day.
"Back to business," thought Tim,
as he resigned himself to being uncomfortable in the loose-fitting one-piece garment, and instead turned his attention to the only other human in the dropship's personnel bay. Support Platoon's Corporal Kofi Okoro sat quietly in his seat by the cockpit hatch, retaining straps still secured, eyes closed, with the outward appearance of someone sleeping. However, he was far from asleep. If you looked closely, you could hardly fail to notice the constant motion of his eyes, or the expensive military-grade slate he held loosely in his lap. Kofi Okoro was a cyber warfare specialist, and right now he was hard at work penetrating Rala Station's security network. Hacking the security network remotely from back on the Glambring had been an option. However, Okoro had pointed out that whenever the dropship was secured into its berth on Rala, it was standard procedure to automatically connect the little ship's navigation systems to the space station's traffic control system. The idea being that whenever the small ship launched again, its pilots would have the most up-to-date data to plot their course through the busy shipping lanes which surrounded the station. What it also did was to give the cyber warfare expert a back door into the station's overarching computer core, one which he was now using to insert a ghost program into the facial recognition program of the security network, which, once complete, would cause the security network to automatically ignore any searches or alerts issued which matched the faces of two particular humans. Alistair Sinclair and Tim Buchanan had, as far as the security computer of Rala Station was concerned, become invisible. Okoro's eyes opened with a deep, gratifying sigh, and a sheepish grin spread across his face.
"You are good to go, sir."
"Outstanding work, Gokoro," said Alistair. "Shall we go pay Dirrell a visit, Tim?"
"Ready when you are, sir," replied Tim. Side by side, the two men headed down the ramp, magnetic grips keeping them firmly attached to the metal deck with each step, preventing them from bouncing ignominiously away in the virtually non-existent gravity of the docking bay. It appeared Rala Station was as busy as usual. Alistair counted five other small vessels in this berth, and it was only one of a dozen that serviced the space station. Ahead of them, the gaggle of El Shah had already reached the bay doors, and were waiting patiently while the station's security system registered each into its database. Like many commercial stations spread throughout known space, Rala Station was owned and maintained by a mix of interested parties, ranging from the merchant and mercenary guilds to the nearby planetary authority. The stations came in all shapes and sizes, and, like everything else in the Galactic Union, the state of repair was dependent on how much profit there was to be made from it. In Rala's case, being in a system which had a moderate-sized F-11 refining capacity, it experienced a good amount of through traffic. And with traffic came profit and opportunity. Not every opportunity was a legal one, a point in case being one Flattar who went by the name of Dirrell. Over the years, the Flattar had been described as many things. However, the best-fitting analogy the humans had come up for them was one-foot-tall chipmunks. Their physical similarity to the striped-furred rodent, prolific in North America and Asia, had caused the first humans to encounter them to initially dismiss them. That was a mistake, and for many a human merc, a fatal one. Flattar were highly intelligent, vicious creatures who enjoyed nothing more than a good fight, especially if they could do it riding high in the saddle of their lifelong companions, Tortantula. Looking like something from a B-movie of the early cinematic film days of the mid-20th century, Tortantula just looked evil. Giant spiders who would kill you as quick as look at you, who, in a twist of Darwinism at its most humorous, bonded for life with their Flattar riders. Whatever the reasoning behind it, the combination of Flattar and Tortantula resulted in mercs from any race having an extremely bad day if they met them in combat. Today, though, Alistair and Tim had no intention of engaging in an armed struggle with Dirrell. But this Flattar had a string to his bow which the two Scorpion troopers needed badly. Dirrell had used his species' guile and cunning to earn him a tidy fortune in another field entirely, the field of information gathering, which the furry little creature sold on to the highest bidder. If anybody knew the location of a covert Science Guild research and development facility that was being funded by General Peepo and her backers, the Flattar on his shiny black nose could dig it up. Given enough time, and plenty of credits, of course. Alistair absent-mindedly patted the breast pocket of his jumpsuit, feeling the reassuring outline of the yak that rested there. Nestled in its integrated circuitry was access to enough credits to buy every vessel in the landing berth twice over, all courtesy of the four horsemen, and some decidedly underhanded banking techniques. Reaching the bay doors, Alistair and Tim halted among the babbling El Shah while the security network's cameras finished their scans of the station's latest visitors. Burrowed deep in the programming matrix, Corporal Okoro's subroutine intercepted the biometric data relating to Alistair and Tim, wiping it from the system, while simultaneously sending a positive instruction into the bay doors to allow access to the main station. The bay doors opened with no sign of an alarm being raised, and Alistair and Tim exchanged a relieved glance as they followed the thigh-high El Shah into the bustling corridor beyond. A pair of bored-looking Lumar, dressed in the uniform of Rala Station security, blatantly ignored the new arrivals as they immersed themselves in a trivee which, from the brief glimpse Alistair got as he went past them, was showing scenes from the brief battle the fleeing human mercenary forces had had with General Pipo's vastly superior ships high above Earth as they fled the planet of their birth. Tim had caught sight of what the Lumar had been watching also, and the telltale tensing of his muscles caused Alastair to nudge him, none too gently. When Tim turned to face Alastair, the older merc could see the anger brewing just below the surface.
"Our time will come, Tim. For now, let's get to Dheeral and his pet spider."
Tim gave the Lumar a last scathing look, which they were totally unaware of, before giving Alastair a curt nod and speaking through gritted teeth.
"Dheeral has a spare part shop on level 3, Spinward, that he uses as a cover for his day-to-day work."
Tim used his pen plans to access the station's chronometer.
"If we hurry, we should just catch him before he closes for the night."
Rala Station may have been in a moderately wealthy system. However, every station that Alastair had ever been on, in his decades as a merc, had its equivalent to this station's level 3. Exiting the lift, his human nostrils were assailed by the unmistakable smell of too many members of too many races living in close quarters. The corridor lighting, what there was of it, flickered and occasionally died totally, turning even the smallest of doorways or corridors into dark expanses which could hold anything or nothing.
"It's about 100 feet up on the left, just beyond that group of Pushtal," said Tim quietly.
He didn't use his hands, because one of the locals might have taken it as an aggressive gesture. Alastair, as casually as he could, turned his upper body in the direction Tim had indicated. Three aliens who resembled dwarf Bengal tigers with bandolier cross harnesses, from which hung high-intensity laser pistols, were in an animated conversation that looked as if, at any moment, it could turn nasty. Pushtal could get like that. Ever since they got their asses handed to them by the Min Sha a couple of centuries back, losing their home planet in the process, they had floated around the galaxy like a bad smell. Some had formed into mediocre merc companies, while the rest resorted to basic thuggery or piracy. Slightly beyond them, a gaudy blue and green sign indicated the entrance to Dheeral's nefarious establishment.
"No time to go the long way around if we want to speak to Dheeral tonight, and I don't feel like wasting a day waiting for him to open tomorrow."
Alastair scanned the corridor leading to the Flattar's store entrance.
"Okay, we don't really have a choice but to go past those arguing Pushtal. We'll cross to the opposite side of the corridor. That should give us a reasonably wide berth."
Tim nodded his agreement before deftly threading his way between a pair of Lotar, haggling with a leather-faced Blevin, whose large, six-fingered hands hovered near an impressive-looking, short, but wide-barreled weapon, which reminded Tim of a blunderbuss of old.
"Old but lethal,"
Tim reminded himself as he moved further along the corridor, managing to skirt the Pushtal, whom were now all displaying razor-sharp fangs and claws.
"Things were about to go south."
Alastair had caught the warning signs, too, and with a final step he pushed the admittance chime located on the edge of Dheeral's door, keeping a wary eye on the Pushtal.
"Come away! We're closed!"
came a scratchy, impatient voice through the speaker grill.
"I have urgent business with a proprietor," said Alastair.
A combination of a short roar slash growls came from one of the Pushtal, while a second took a step back away from the two main agitators. Others in the corridor had now noticed the impending fight and had begun to clear a large area around the two tigers. Alastair was running out of time.
"I have deep pockets if it is a matter of money. But if you don't want my money, I will take my business elsewhere. You decide, and decide now, so I can be on my way."
With a click, the door lock was released, and, with infuriating slowness, The door retracted to the side. As soon as it was open wide enough, Tim pushed Alistair through and backhanded the door close switch. The door had not quite closed when an enraged roar echoed up and down the corridor, immediately followed by the boom of a chemical-based weapon firing. The door sealed, leaving the events of outside to the imagination. Tim spun on his heel to be confronted by raised pedipalpi, with sharp, jagged ridges at their ends. Tim's eyes followed the pedipalpi up until they reached the gaping maw of a fully grown tortantula, its multiple, dark-as-night eyes fixed on him, unblinking. Tim's tongue darted between dry lips.
"Hey, Ziorta, long time no see,"
he managed to get out with more confidence than he felt. From behind one of the Tortantula's multi-segmented legs, a small, gray-and-black furred head popped into view.
"Well, well, well, if it isn't Tim Buchanan," came a slightly high-pitched, squeaky voice.
A body, covered in the same fur as the head, detached itself from behind the large Tortantula's leg, the oversized laser pistol loosely held in one hand, still aimed in the general direction of Alistair, who was pinned to the wall by one of the Tortantula's rear legs. Tim managed to drag his eyes from the razor-sharp teeth, which filled the giant spider's mouth only a few feet from his face. Tilting his head to the side, he gave the Flattar a weak smile.
"Hey, Deral, any chance you might call Ziorta off me and my friend here, so we can talk a little business?"
The Flattar let out a chattering laugh.
"Now why would I do that, Captain Buchanan of Sinclair's Scorpions and..."
Deral waved the pistol toward Alistair.
"If I'm not mistaken, your companion would be none other than Colonel Alistair Sinclair, commander of the Scorpions." "Tut, tut, tut. Don't you know that you were supposed to have presented yourselves to face trial on Capital Planet by now?"
Deral looked from Tim to Alistair and back to Tim.
"Nothing to say, human? Oh, well. Perhaps I shall just hand you over to General Peepaw myself. I'm sure she has an ample reward posted for you by now."
"What if I offered you twice as much to let us go?"
said Alistair to Deral's back.
"And twice as much again, for information."
The Flattar paused briefly before turning back to face Alistair.
"And how do I know that you have such funds to hand? I don't take credit, you know,"
Deral said with a wicked grin. Now it was Alistair's time to grin. Slowly, so as not to agitate the Tortantula, who could easily squash him with one leg, or the Flattar, who could hold him with his laser pistol, he retrieved the yak from his pocket and offered it out to Deral. The Flattar took it from him and touched it to a slate which had appeared in his free hand. Seconds later, the slate let out a gentle beep, and Deral's mouth fell open. Without taking his eyes from the slate, he addressed his Tortantula.
"Release our new friend, Ziorta."
The Tortantula removed its leg from Alistair's chest, and Tim let out a small sigh of relief as the gaping mouth closed and the blades, which could easily slice him to pieces in one easy move, were retracted. Deral returned the yak to Alistair with a flourish.
"And how can this poor merchant be of assistance to you?"
Alistair let the sarcasm slip.
"Tim tells me that when he last had dealings with you, you mentioned you had got wind of a rather odd rumor. The rumor was that the Mercenary Guild had commissioned the Science Guild to complete some mysterious project for them."
"That is true, Colonel Sinclair. Rumor had it the Mercenary Guild wanted the Science Guild to develop a new ultra-compact power source for them."
Alistair and Tim exchanged a glance.
"So it was true," thought Alistair. "But what the hell did the Merc Guild want something like a miniature, super-powerful energy source for?"
Are they planning to bring the ancient Ragnars back to life themselves? Or was it for another weapon system they had yet to reveal? Whatever, we must get our hands on it, if the Four Horsemen's plans to kick people's ass are to come to fruition.
Our employers are interested in knowing the location of the Science Guild's new toys development facility, said Tim.
Dear Al rubbed at his snout slowly.
It's not cheap. The Merc Guild are playing this one pretty close to their chests. But I think I can help you out.
Dear Al gave the two humans a sly grin.
For a price, of course.
Alistair took the slate from Dearall and tapped the yak to it before tapping the screen and handing it back to the Flattar.
Is this a sufficient down payment?
The slate nearly slipped from Dearall's fingers as his brain registered the number highlighted on the slate screen. Recovering quickly, he mimicked, tipping his hat to Alistair.
I believe that figure is sufficient, Colonel Sinclair.
And how quickly can you obtain the information I require? Asked Alistair.
Station security is a joke here, Colonel. However, I am still subject to the occasional random inspection, so I keep my more, shall we say, sensitive information elsewhere, and I must physically recover it. Why don't you return tomorrow at this time, and we can conclude our business?
I look forward to it, dear Al, said Alistair.
You should leave by the rear entrance, said Ziorta,
indicating the Trivi, which displayed the footage from the surveillance camera on the store's main entrance corridor. A group of Lumar security forces were gathered around the motionless body of a Pushtal. Blood splatter coated the walls and floor around the fallen alien. Of the other Pushtal there was no sign. The Lumar were stopping and interrogating any onlookers or passers-by.
Ziorta is right. I don't think we need any undue attention from security, agreed Tim.
Dearall approached a section of wall which looked the same as any other in the cluttered store. As he laid his flattened palm on it, the concealed biometric reader confirmed his identity, and a crack in the wall expanded until it became a narrow doorway.
Follow the passage to the end, and it will bring you out near the elevators.
Till tomorrow, Dearall, said Alistair.
Till tomorrow, Colonel Sinclair, replied Dearall.
The emergence point, 2,000 miles sunward of Rala Station, was empty one second, but for a few scattered hydrogen atoms, and the next, filled by the sleek lines of an expensive space yacht transitioning back to normal space. Carrying almost no Delta-V, it gave the most Spartan nudge of its attitude jets to orient itself, before activating its ion drive and setting course for the floating space station. Rala Station Traffic Control interrogated the yacht's transponder, which identified it as the plaything of a ridiculously rich Wathayat trader. Traffic control wasted no time in assigning one of the private landing berths, and was just as swiftly rewarded by an electronic payment securing the berth for a week. Satisfied everything was in order, the staff of traffic control cleared down their screens awaiting their next arrival, an inbound mile-wide megaton freighter, which would require their full attention. Aboard the yacht, a distinctly feline-like creature gave a slow blink of amusement. Kitta, of the Deepak, had arrived in Rala, and the lifespan of her target could now be counted in hours. Charlie Sinclair let out a breath he hadn't realized he'd been holding, as the merchant ship Tlakaz passed through the Stargate and entered hyperspace, leaving the Tal system in its wake. 10 days of skulking around the various bars and dives of Tal Station, at a shitload of credits, all in cash, of course, had secured Charlie and the Scorpion troopers of Gamma Company passage on what could best be described as a bucket of bolts held together by spit and twine. No matter, thought Charlie. The Tla Kaza's captain, a weasel-like Zupati who recognized a good deal when he saw one, had agreed to take them as far as the Elo system and the Cimarron arm, where Charlie would have to source another ride. Elo may not have been in the right direction for Earth. However, as Charlie had pointed out to his ranking officers, Tory MacDonald and Stacy Kamala, human merc companies were now considered fair game, and he would rather spend time going the long way around and get home safely than fight every alien merc out to make a quick credit by bringing a few human scalps into the merc guild. Charlie released his restraints as the freighter's gravity deck extended out from the main hull and began its steady rotation, until gravity had settled on a steady 1G. Rolling his shoulders and flexing his legs to release the pent-up energy that the anxiousness of the past few days had brought on, he thought about his wife, Mary, and the kids, before admonishing himself.
Snap out of it, Charlie. You can bet next month's pay that Mari and the kids are sitting comfortably at the lodge, or playing in the cool waters of Loch Ness, hoping to catch a glimpse of the mythical monster.
It was going to be a long enough 170 hours to Elo, without worrying about something he had no control over. And if he was thinking about home, then you could bet his troopers were doing the same thing. Accessing his comms, he scheduled a meeting with his officers and senior non-coms for an hour's time. Some routine training would break the monotony of a week in hyper. Chapter 9 Easy Money. The tingling of his pin plants woke Alastair Sinclair before the beeping of the slate, which lay on its shelf beside his cot. Without opening his eyes, he accepted the message, which appeared as if projected onto his inner eyelids. The message was a request from Captain Cthu to contact him urgently. Alastair accessed the Glambring's internal sensor system, which located the Elshaw captain in an instant. The captain was on the bridge, and a sidebar indicated the ship was being brought to full readiness. Something was up. With a command, Alastair pinged Captain Cthu to let him know he was online. Cthu activated the camera in front of his command chair, and the sleek image of the Elshaw replaced his message in Alastair's simulated vision.
Colonel Sinclair, a pair of Hexshaw cruisers have completed translation and are assuming parking orbits. They have requested permission to allow their crews shore leave and are preparing shuttles for this purpose. We have matched the cruiser's signatures with recordings the Bucephalus intercepted as it departed Earth. It's a safe bet these ships are loyal to General Peepo.
Shit.
Alastair cursed under his breath. His meeting with Dhiral was not due to happen for another 2 hours, yet it looked like the Hexshaw were going to force his hand. If they recognized the Glambring for what she really was, a winged hussar's ship, then they would not hesitate to open fire on her, and no matter how good a captain Cthu was, the Glambring was only a frigate, and up against a single cruiser, never mind two, it would be a short, sharp fight, which could only end up with the Glambring becoming expanding gases in short order.
Very well, Captain. Please have a dropship prepared for immediate departure, and warn off Captain Buchanan that we will be departing for the station as soon as possible.
Cthu gave a single nod of compliance.
Consider it done, Colonel. I shall contact the Stargate and see if we can bring forward our departure time. Hopefully we can retrieve the information from Dhiral and his pet Tortantula without alerting the Hexshaw to our presence.
Fat chance,
thought Alastair. He terminated the link with Cthu while swinging himself upright. The purple shipsuit hung by the door to the small cabin, next to a set of lightweight body armor and a shoulder holster containing a rapid-fire flechette pistol. With a magazine capacity of 100 rounds of 2-inch-long tungsten carbide flechettes, the magnetically charged rails of the pistol could accelerate the metal dart up to a speed of 2,500 feet per second. Any opponent would need reaction speeds of twice that of an Olympic sprinter, and be 500 feet away to dodge a dart. And best of all, there was no recoil to disturb Alistair's aim. If you saw your target, you hit your target. And if you were unlucky enough to be the target, the flechette was almost guaranteed to penetrate any lightweight armor or thick alien hide. Alistair slipped on the ship suit, left his cabin, and headed for the starboard airlock securing his dropship. On reaching it, the two pilots were already running their pre-flight checks as part of the Glambring's heightened alert status. Time dragged, though it was probably only another couple of minutes before a slightly out-of-breath Tim Buchanan, closely followed by Corporal Kofi Okoro, joined him and a single El Shah dressed in the same purple jumpsuit they had used as cover before. This El Shah, however, did not look as enthusiastic as the last group which had accompanied Alistair and Tim to the station.
"He was unlucky enough to be passing me in the corridor, so I scooped him up and hung the jumpsuit on him. At least we can pretend to be coming back for more spares," said Tim with a shrug of his shoulders.
"Let's get moving, Tim,"
Alistair said, reaching for the handle above the airlock.
"One minute, sir,"
said Tim, looking back the way he and Okoro had come. Alistair gave him a quizzical look, which transformed into one of annoyance when his second-in-command continued to look back down the corridor. Alistair was about to berate him when First Sergeant Kroll and two Scorpion troopers, Jackson and Terhune, came bouncing around the bend. The three of them wore tan Scorpion's uniform and tactical gear, making no attempt to hide the fact they were mercs. Each carried a full combat loadout. Their Gal-12 assault rifles were locked and loaded, and the laser pistols attached to their chest plates blinked the green of a full charge.
"I thought we might need a bit of backup, and the First Sergeant was complaining he needed to stretch his legs," Tim said with a thin smile.
Alistair spared a glance for the grim-faced Kroll and his two troopers, and gave a curt nod.
"Better to have them than to be looking for them, I suppose."
With that, he pushed off down the umbilical, joining the dropship to the airlock, nimbly pivoting himself on a handhold and slipping into a seat, the restraints deploying to secure him in place. Looking across at Kroll, Alistair hoped the trooper's extra firepower would not be required. However, the experienced merc commander in him knew how the god Murphy enjoyed throwing spanners in the best-laid plans. With a shudder, the dropship disengaged its locking clamps and maneuvered clear of the Glambring, before a burst from its engine sent it arrowing for Rala Station. Alistair closed his eyes and brought up the exterior cameras. A few seconds to orient himself, and he was able to locate the two Hexshaw cruisers. Magnifying the image, the empty locks where the cruiser's own parasitic small craft should be hanging told its own story. Some of the cruiser's crew were already aboard the station.
"Could this go any more wrong?" wondered Alistair.
The short journey to the station was over in a couple of minutes, and Alistair was out of his seat before the dropship had come to a complete stop. As soon as the power and comms umbilical were attached, Corporal Okoro worked his magic. Alistair and Tim were invisible to the station's security network once more. Kroll flashed the colonel a thumbs up, which Alistair returned as he headed into the station.
"Easiest credits we have ever made," said Dirall, as he punched in the code which unlocked his store's front door.
"If you say so," agreed Zayorda.
The Tortantula was grumpy. She didn't like making the 6-hour round trip to the small moonlet where Dirall had built a habitat just big enough to hold his ill-gotten gains, and the secure servers where he stored the most sensitive of the information that was the basis of his business. Schematics for the latest tech from the biggest conglomerates in the Galactic Union. Industrial secrets that would fetch a pretty penny if the right buyer could be found. Information pertaining to upcoming mercenary guild contracts that would allow a smart competitor to undercut his opposition. If you needed it, Dearall was the Flatar who got it. It was an open secret, but one that those in power tolerated, because the Flatar could be useful to them one day, too. Dearall never considered that, sooner or later, one of his clients, or perhaps one of his victims, would decide that his usefulness should come to an end.